The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 12-1742 and 13-364, State of Ohio, ex rel. Anthony Sylvester, AAA Sly Bail Bonds, and State of Ohio, ex rel. Woodrow L. Fox and Woody Fox Bail Bonds, LLC, versus Tim Neal, Wayne County Clerk of Courts, and Gary Walters et al. For the relator, we have Ms. Carpenter.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. In Smith versus Lease, this court has already determined that a cash-only bail provision is unconstitutional under Section 9, Article 1 of the Ohio Constitution, and is not authorized by either Criminal Rule 46 or under Revised Code 2937.222. I tell you today the only reason that we are here before you today is because the respondents simply do not want to abide by your precedent and need to be reminded of your ruling in Smith versus Lease. The sole purpose of bail is to make sure that a defendant shows up at the next court hearing. But that's not what the Licking County respondents are doing. This court—
Counsel, what interest does the state have in a determination of a surety or a cash requirement?
If I understand your question right, Chief Justice, are you asking why should the court care about a surety?
Okay.
I just want to make sure I answer your question. The Ohio Constitution affords every Ohio citizen to be bailable, except for two situations with a felony or a dangerous situation, a capital offense. The Ohio Constitution affords every Ohio citizen the right to a surety, to a sufficient surety to be bailable out of jail, so that no citizen is unduly detained in jail beyond what is necessary.
Counsel, I think I want to follow. Oh, go ahead.
Excuse me, you didn't really answer my question. Right. Why do the respondents have an interest in whether it's a cash or a surety?
I apologize, Your Honor. That's a very good question. The point is, when a 10% bond is set, for example, a $100,000 bail is set, 10% of that, what the respondents are doing, saying must be paid in cash. If that money is being paid in cash to the court, if the defendant then shows up at the next court hearing, he gets to be refunded 90% of that money, but the court keeps 10% of the 10%. If a bail bondsman issues a surety bond, the court does not make any money from that. The bond is posted like an insurance policy, and if the person shows up, then the bond has been satisfied.
So I guess that's what I'm backing up on the chief's question. I'm not sure I'm hearing your answer. What interest does the court have in establishing a bond procedure, whether it be through a bondsman or cash or grandma putting up the house? What is the interest of the court? It's to get the person there, is it not?
The purpose of bond, yes, Your Honor, is to get the person, incentivize the person to show up. This court's interest has already been established in Smith versus Lease, who said that a cash-only bond is unconstitutional, and it's the Ohio citizen's right. It's just simply enforcing what the Ohio Constitution states and has stated since 1803, and what this court has maintained as precedent at least since 2005.
But if I may, it seems to me that the arguments being made here that, you know, the 10% might be unreachable by some poor people, but isn't the reality, to get a bondsman interested, you're still going to come up with a 10%, are you not?
You do make a point, Your Honor, and yes, the bondsman will be paid the 10%, but that's not what the controlling interest here. It's not about who makes the money. Certainly, someone is going to make money, whether it's the court, which shouldn't be used as a revenue system, or the bail bondsman. But it goes back to the Constitution, that an Ohio citizen should not be unduly jailed simply because he can't come up with a full 10%.
Well, isn't it really a question of shouldn't it not be the defendant's choice on how they post bond? If there's these means of posting bond, surety, cash, or whatever, that the court should not care as long as there's a bond posted and the defendant appears.
That's exactly right, Chief Justice. That's exactly right. The court should not care because
one of the interesting things that I found in reading the briefs was that when there's a 10% bond, a bail bondsman coming in and posting a 100% surety rather than just 10% is not accepted.
That's right. And in fact, what's also not accepted is if a third party, a non-commercial bondsman, comes in and wants to pay the entire amount of bail, that's not being accepted either. Because if the defendant shows up, all that money has to be refunded. The court doesn't get to keep a dime of that. And there's many different forms of surety. I'm not here to tell you today or ask you today to define a surety as a bail bondsman. There's many forms of sureties. But the point is, going back to the justices, going back to one of the justices' point, is it is the right of the defendant to choose. That's what this court has already decided.
Is the benefit of a 10% cash bond inuring to the defendant or to the court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, if the bond is, as you suggest, $100,000 and the court permits a 10% bond, does that benefit the defendant or does that benefit the court?
Well, it certainly benefits the court more than it benefits the defendant.
Because you think the court gets $1,000 on that.
The court absolutely gets $1,000. I probably should do the math in my head, but they get to keep 90% of that 10% that is put down.
So
no, the defendant keeps 90%.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. The defendant keeps 90%. The court will keep 10% of the 10%. Correct.
So if that same defendant went to your client, what would be the economics of the transaction?
Well, the economics of the transaction is 10%. However,
so your client would still pay $10,000, only it would pay it to your client instead of the court, right?
Yes, but there's options, Your Honor.
And they would be what?
The options that are provided by a bonding company. It can be either a payment plan, it can be a credit card company, but the biggest, and I think if we're talking just about a bonding company, if you have a $100,000 bond and you have a third party coming in to put that bond down, if they put it down with the court, that third party then is completely liable for the entire amount. But they can't, they don't have the jurisdiction, they don't have the ability to go and chase down the person who doesn't show up in court. Whereas a bail bondsman, a third party can walk in, pay the money, and put their hands up and say, I've done my duty, I'm not liable for this defendant showing up. And I think that that helps to get people out of jail and not unduly detain them any more than needs to be. I mean, we have real risk.
So the cost of the defendant is the same either way. Financial, the out-of-pocket expenditure, if the defendant has a $100,000 bond requirement and hires and uses your client and makes the court appearances, how much would the defendant be out-of-pocket when the game's over?
I understand, Judge Justice.
Well, it's not Piper. A complicated question for you
it's
to
a
understand.
It's a 10%, just like they would pay to the court.
What's the answer? What's the answer to the question?
It would be the 10% that the defendant would pay to the court. The same amount that the defendant would pay to the court.
So the defendant would be out $1,000.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not. Oh. I don't mean to frustrate you, certainly standing here before you today.
A $100,000 bond.
$10,000 would go to the bail bondsman.
All right. And when the defendant makes all of his court appearances, what does the bail bondsman keep?
He keeps the $10,000.
So it's 10 times as much to the defendant?
It depends on who's making the payment, Your Honor, and it depends on
The math is not complicated. The defendant is ordered to post a $100,000 bond. The court in this case is saying, put $10,000 in here to the clerk, and if you show up, you'll get $9,000 back.
Correct.
So you're out $1,000.
Correct.
Okay. If the same defendant, same bond requirement, makes the same appearances, hires your client, how much is the defendant out when the case is over?
They are out the full 10% to a bail bondsman, Your Honor, but that's not the point. The point is this court has already decided that it's the defendant's choice and to a right to a third-party surety, a sufficient surety at that. It's not up to the court. This is not about a commercial bail bondsman. Not every defendant has the means.
Well, wait a minute. That's not exactly true, though, is it? Wasn't the Constitution amended, and didn't the people of Ohio say it's just fine that the court can determine any time, type, amount, and conditions of bail? Isn't that what Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution now reads?
That's exactly what it reads, Your Honor. However, this court...
Isn't that what these courts did? They said, well, in answer to Justice Pfeiffer, we're not going to let bail bondsmen keep the $10,000. We're going to say in our court, put up to 10 and you get 9 back. What's wrong with that on a constitutional basis as amended?
In the 1998 amendments, this court decided Smith versus Lease in 2005, and they looked at what the constitutional provisions had morphed to. And in fact, Rule 46 had also been amended. And this court has already morphed those together, have already said that they need to be harmonized, they need to be read together, and they've already decided that. And they decided that once the amount of bond has been set, the trial court, has absolutely no interest in how the bond is satisfied.
But the court has full discretion to set the type and kind of bond.
Correct.
You agree?
I agree.
And the purposes are to protect the public from the activities of an errant citizen and to ensure the appearance of that individual in court. And isn't the discretion then with the trial court judge to set the type and kind of bond that will protect the public and ensure the person's appearance?
And don't we
give that discretion to trial court judges?
Justice O'Donnell, I respectfully disagree with you. The purpose and the sole purpose of bond, as this court has already said, is to ensure the appearance of the defendant at court.
And not to protect the public.
That is not the purpose of bond.
Well, that's what the federal authorities have said, isn't it? Isn't that the federal standard?
That might be federal standard, but this is not a federal...
We're not worried about the public, in your view.
Well, I certainly worry about the public, but that's already taken account for in the Constitution. When the 1998 amendment was put in place, in fact, the sole purpose, as this court found, the purpose of the 1998 amendment to the Constitution was to restrict certain people from bonding out, from bailing out, and that was anyone who had been, it's always been this case, charged with a capital crime, and then they also put in a provision that with a certain class of felonies that presented an imminent source of danger. And this court stated in
and that would require that they were not bondable at that point and that they would remain incarcerated pending their trial.
That's correct, Justice.
And the bond then is only for those who are eligible, in other words, deemed not to be a threat to witnesses or the public at large.
That's correct, Chief Justice. And if I may end with just going back to paragraph 34 in your Jones case, that was decided before Smith versus Lease, stating that once a judge has chosen the bond amount, there was no legitimate purpose in specifying the form of the bond which might be posted. Thank you.
Mr. Kuzma, you have a little over a minute.
That's all I have, huh? Well, Your Honors, what this is about is if you're going to force somebody to post cash with the courts, how can you call it anything but a cash-only bond? This court has ruled three times. It's ruled in the Troutman case, it's ruled in the Jones case, and it's ruled in Lesch that a cash-only bond is unconstitutional. If you're going to force somebody to take cash and deposit it with the court to ensure the defendant's release, and that is something the court determines, that a judge determines that somebody's eligible for bond, once they do that, the judge cannot force that person to put up cash. When we're looking at the options as they were amended, the courts have always read those as being expansive options.
But isn't this an opportunity for a defendant to get 90% of the amount posted back?
Absolutely, but
so
the problem is
doesn't
finance.
Doesn't the 10%, in Justice Pfeiffer's example, inure to the benefit of the defendant? Because if the defendant makes all of the appearances in court, then $9,000 of that $10,000 bond would be refunded to the defendant.
The case that I brought to this court, okay, which was the Sylvester case, the defendant in that case, the family could not come up with the 10%.
Well, if they couldn't come up with the 10%, how could the surety?
Because the surety finances. The surety was willing to work with the family over time, held things as collateral, and was going to finance the bond. The courts will not finance the bonds. If you do not have the 10%, you have to sit in jail. Now, you're not convicted. All you've been is charged. A judge has determined that you're eligible for bond. So you're not guilty right now.
And
you're
so
innocent.
Your argument is that it's an abuse of discretion for a trial court to refuse to convert a 10% bond to a surety bond.
Not an abuse of discretion. What I'm saying is these should be read expansively. What these are to do is to
when you
protect.
Say these, what are you referring
okay,
to?
Okay, when you're looking at there are three types of bonds we can post. We can post our own recognizance, we can post a 10% bond, or we can post a surety bond.
Well, those are by our court rule.
By the court rules, and also when you look at Rule 46, those are the three types of bonds we're looking at, okay? When you look at those, you're given the defendant options. When a judge says 10%, what he's done is he's added another option to how a defendant can be released, okay? Instead of it limiting it to that only, a surety should still be able to come in and put up a surety bond. My client tried to post 100% cash in that case and was told no. Now, why would a court refuse 100% cash? I have no idea. But in that case, the lady had to sit. They wouldn't take 100% cash, but they would take 10% cash.
So it's a matter of interpretation of 46, Civil Rule 46 that you're talking about. Because in Smith versus Lease, we specifically looked at the first clause of the Constitution that said, all persons shall be bailable by sufficient sureties. And your point is that there are certain times that a surety bond is to the advantage of the defendant. Not in every situation is it the same as a 10% cash bond.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So is it your subliminal argument that the court in this instance is interested in the 1% of the amount posted? In the 10% posting of a cash bond, the court is interested in keeping 1%? Is that what you're arguing
to us? I would say that there is probably some underlying desire on a court's part as another revenue stream. Yes, Your Honor, because why else are you going to not take cash only? And my client actually tried to hand the clerk the cash, not a check, cash money.
I thought you said your client couldn't post even the 10%.
They couldn't. They tried to give 100% cash. They eventually put up the 10%. They would accept the 10%. They would not accept 100% cash. Okay. The only reason not to accept 100% cash in that situation is they wanted to take their 1%. Okay. But that's not the gist of what's going on here. This court has ruled three times, not once, since we had the Baker case in 1990, this court has ruled in Baker v. Troutman and Jones v. Hedren and Smith v. Lesch, the cash-only bond is unconstitutional. And if you're going to force somebody to post cash with the court, what are you doing other than saying it's a cash-only bond?
It wasn't a sufficient surety. Isn't that the basis of the lease case?
That was the basis of the lease case. But they also said in the lease case that cash-only is unconstitutional. Okay.
Because it was punitive and was held punitive. The individual in jail when that person should be subject to a sufficient surety. That was the analysis.
That's correct. Okay. But if you're to 10%, is that sufficient surety? It's cash again. Okay. In the Hedren case, we weren't talking about sufficient surety. What they were saying is the Hedren case is very analogous to what we're looking at here, because what was going on is the court was saying you got to forfeit your bond to pay fines and costs.
Is there any analysis of the propensity for harm to the public in setting these bonds that courts undertake?
Well, the judge has the discretion of setting a bond at an amount that he determines will protect the public, okay? So he can go and say, and he can also look at, he has the ability to look at the defendant's criminal history, okay, to look at everything associated with that defendant and determining if he's even eligible.
So are you saying that a trial court does not have the ability to set a 10% cash-only bond?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, Your Honor.
They can do a 10% bond. They just can't do a cash-only bond. And that's the distinction you're drawing here, is cash is cash. Whether it's 100%, a demand for 100% cash or the demand for 10% cash, you should be able to substitute the cash with a surety.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Is our rule unconstitutional in that it requires a 10% cash, in your view?
No, because you can read it harmoniously. Okay, you can read it in imperium with the rest of the rules and have that being another option, and a judge can say cash surety 10% and give the defendant all the options. Right now, a judge does not have to say 10%. They can say cash surety only. Sure. Okay. And so we give the defendant more options by doing that. Okay.
Thank you.
We don't limit their options.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is it Mr. Armstrong?
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Christopher Armstrong on behalf of amicus curiae, Attorney General Mike DeWine, we're arguing today in support of the respondents. Your Honors, Criminal Rule 46A2 does not violate Article 1, Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution, which guarantees all defendants, as you've heard, the right to be bailable by sufficient sureties. And in Smith versus Lees, what this court said was any type of bail can be constitutional. The Constitution is silent as to the type of bail that courts may.
Counsel, if I may, I think I understand the economics and the dynamics here. And I'm from Ashtabula County, and we used to have Brownie as our bailsman, and everybody showed up that time. However, the point is being made on the other table there that once the judge decides how much the bond shall be, I think what I'm hearing here, that the court has no legitimate interest on a constitutional basis for how that money comes into the courthouse steps. What do you say to that?
There is a legitimate constitutional interest in setting a 10% bond under Criminal Rule 46A2, and that is that the rule allows the court to provide the defendant a carrot instead of just a stick in order to ensure the defendant's appearance at trial. Because the court can't obviously force a bail bondsman or another surety to refund any of the defendant's money that the defendant might put down on the bond, the court, though, can do that itself.
Well, maybe maybe I'm not saying my question properly. We've all seen the cases where the court says, $1 million bond, this is a very dangerous person. You come up with $1 million, you're out, right?
Correct.
Once the court does that, why do they have a legitimate constitutional interest in where that $1 million comes from?
And the answer is that the court has an interest in selecting the right combination of sanctions, the right incentives to ensure the defendant's appearance and to protect the public. And what Criminal Rule 46A2 does is it gives the court a tool to, rather than just have the defendant have negative consequences for not appearing, which would be a capias or forfeiting the bond amount, it actually provides the defendant with a positive consequence for appearing. And the court, it gives the court the discretion to decide, this is a person who needs, you know, a carrot instead of a stick in order to ensure their appearance at trial. And that's a reason that the Constitution would sanction.
If I understood Mr. Kuzma's argument, his client didn't have the 10% to post in cash with the court, but he could finance that 10% with a bondsman. And he was seeking the opportunity from the court to do that so he could be released from jail and then have to deal with the financial aspects between himself and the bonding company. And he's arguing that, you know, subliminally, the court's interested in getting its hands on the $1,000 that would have been left in the till, and so the court's unreasonable in not permitting this other type of bond.
And
what's your response to that? It seems like that inures to the benefit of the defendant and still guarantees the court's $100,000 or $200,000 bond is posted.
And my response to that would be, number one, Mr. Kuzma's client is the bail bondsman, not the defendant, and that's an important factor in this case. Number two, there's no indication that I'm aware of that Mr. Kuzma's client's client applied for a modification of bail that was denied. I think what happened was that the bondsman attempted to pay in multiple different ways and was told the bondsman went in and tried to pay in 100% cash and tried to pay the 10% in cash and was told this is what the bond requires, that you pay 10% in cash. I'm not aware, and this is certainly not before this court. This isn't a habeas.
Why would
case.
That matter? Whether or not they tried to negotiate with the court a lower bond or whatever. I mean, we're not here on this specific case alone.
Correct.
We wouldn't be here if that was the issue. This is a much bigger picture.
It is a much bigger picture, but I think it's important because this is a case about how this rule operates on the larger scale,
right.
Not in this
particular
case.
It is, and it was you know, it's interesting that I believe the Attorney General was on the other side in the Lease case. Were you not?
The Attorney General's position in the Lease case, I believe, was that the rule that the court didn't need to reach the constitutional provision. The Attorney General believed in the Lease case that cash only, 100% cash only bond was unconstitutional, but that the rule did not provide for it. That the courts who were saying under Criminal Rule 46A3, which does provide explicitly under that subsection, provides the defendants with a choice to post cash, real estate, or surety.
That choice should be exercised.
Exactly.
The argument here is that it's the defendant's ability to exercise that choice, and if one of those choices involves a bail bondsman, then so be it.
That's not the way the rule reads in this instance, Your Honor, because the rule provides that the court may set bail under one or more of the three prongs of Criminal Rule 46A. Criminal Rule 46A1 provides for release on the defendant's own recognizance or an unsecured bail bond. A2 is the issue that we're talking about now, which is a bail bond secured by 10%. And A3 provides the defendants with a choice of cash, surety, or real estate.
Well, counsel, then, don't we have a problem here? Don't we have a problem on a constitutional basis? What if at the next judicial conference, some judge says, why don't you just get rid of all bail bondsmen? We're not going to have them, and you all get to keep 1% of the bail money, and that's how we're going to balance our budget. Can they do that under the Constitution?
They could.
That is what's happened in these cases, has it not?
To the extent that the bail bondsmen are not interested in assisting with a 10% bond, yes.
Well, these courts that are before us today have said we are not permitting bail bondsmen to operate in our county. Have they not?
No, they've said we're not. They've said in this particular case, we're not going to accept a surety bond instrument.
Because?
Under Criminal Rule 46A2, because we want the defendant to be able to pay the 10% into the court and get that 90%
Why
back.
Why is that an interest to the court to have that 10%? You say it's the carrot, the incentive?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Because think about it, if from the perspective of a defendant, if I'm a criminal defendant, I'm arrested on an F4 drug trafficking charge, and I'm sitting in jail, and I know that I need to come up with, the court sets my bond at $5,000, and I know that I need to come up with 10% somehow. I could pay that 10% if the writ issues and the clerks and the courts are ordered to accept a surety bond or the 10% cash and bail bond under 46A2, I could pay 10% to the bail bondsman, which would be $500, and my $500 is gone. And then, even when I show up, I have no positive.
You have bigger problems than the bail bondsman $500 if you don't show up. Is that not true?
That is absolutely true.
You know, I don't think that the decision about my bond for $500 is a motivator for F4 drug traffickers.
And that may be the case, but on the other hand, from the criminal defendant's perspective, if the defendant pays the $500 into the court and can, retain the $450 back,
and put it in his account when he goes into the institution.
I'm sorry.
I mean, chances are they're going to be incarcerated, so we're really not talking of much incentive in this argument. Let me ask you in a different line: if someone's sitting in jail. I mean, we hear about the cost to counties for incarcerating these individuals as they await trial, and the thrust is to get those who do not need to be in jail out. That is the motivation for county commissioners, for sheriffs, and even the courts. And yet the system that you are advocating to preclude a means to be used in order to relieve the cost on the local government that's exactly what you're doing. You're precluding the ability for the local government to use this as a cost-cutting measure.
That's only to the extent that I think in a very small percentage of cases in which the defendant is somehow would be able to pay the bondsman but would not be able to pay the court. That subset of...
Would you repeat that?
Certainly. Because the bondsmen are also charging 10%. So I think it's probably a very small subset of folks who are able to endure.
Do you know that? Do you have statistics on that? Do you have any information, or is that just your gut?
That's what the relators have admitted in the case. We don't have any evidence in the case on that, no, Your Honor. That wasn't submitted by the parties.
Okay. So you say that either way you look at it, whether it's hiring a bail bondsman or posting 10%, they're going to get out of jail.
Correct. I mean, yes. And as I was saying, I think it's probably a small subset of folks who are unable to, who are somehow able to pay the 10% to the bail bondsman, but are unable to pay the 10%.
Well, you know, the bail bondsman will do the financing and whatever their methods of accomplishing their goals are, and that's not available to defendants who are requiring the 10% cash.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. Number one, the Constitution, it may be slightly less convenient, it may be slightly less one-stop shop to go through the court. You may need someone to get a cash advance on a credit card. You may need someone to go to the pawn shop for you. But the Constitution doesn't guarantee the right to the most expedient surety. It guarantees the right to a sufficient surety. And when the Constitution of 1802 was adopted, the commercial bail bond industry did not exist. And so the word surety, as used in that Constitution and incorporated in subsequent revisions, means, and as this court held in Smith versus Lees, a person who's primarily liable to pay your debt or to assume your obligation. That could be a commercial bail bondsman, it could be a spouse, a friend, a grandmother, it could be anyone.
So why doesn't the procedure that is objectionable here, why isn't that procedure violating the statement in the Constitution that people shall be bailable by sufficient sureties? I mean, your opponents are suggesting that this opens up the options for the defendants, and you're suggesting what?
We're suggesting that under Criminal Rule 46A2, if you're a defendant, you may have someone else pay the 10% for you, a surety. You may have someone else execute the bail bond for you and be liable for the remaining 90% if you don't appear, and that person is a surety. So under Criminal Rule 46A2, you are able to use a surety to bail yourself out of jail, and that is exactly what the Constitution guarantees.
If all the stars align and you have those type of people in your life, and yes, you probably can do that. But what happens to the majority of defendants who don't have that kind of a support system?
And their solution may be, Your Honor, to request a bail modification. That happened in
some
of the...
And say the judge says no.
And then if the judge says, again, given Your Honor's concern about clearing out the jail pending trial, I'd be hard-pressed to see why. But if the judge had, you know, a specific reason for wanting, you know, to go with Criminal Rule 46A2, again, there's no guarantee that you're going to have a surety available. It's just that you have the right to use a surety. And I'd like to make another point, which
is
that...
Well, wait a minute. That doesn't make sense to say that just because the Constitution guarantees it, if you can't acquire it, that's too bad?
There are some people, Your Honor, who don't have a grandma, who don't have a friend. There are some people,
that's
Your Honor...
That's why bail bondsmen are in existence.
There are some people, Your Honor, for whom a bail bondsman will not write a bond. Prostitutes with long rap sheets, out-of-state defendants, homeless individuals. These people also may not have access to a commercial surety.
This is a very nice esoteric argument, but the practicality is that we have a court that says we're not taking anything but a 10% cash bond. And the question I have for you is, why won't the court accept a surety in lieu of a 10%?
And Your Honor,
is there any good reason you can give us?
There's no evidence in the case as to any particular judge's motivation on this. I think the good reason is...
It's not the question about the motivation of the court. The question is, what's the difference to the court in accepting a 10% cash only or a surety?
The difference to the court is that the defendant has that added incentive of getting some of that money back.
Sorry?
The defendant has that added incentive of getting some of that money back, and it may, in fact,
enhance the defendant. And if the defendant doesn't want to get some of that money back?
I'm sorry?
If the defendant doesn't want to get some of that money back, why can't the defendant post a surety bond?
Again, because the court has made the determination that this is the appropriate level of incentive to induce this particular person.
And what test do they use to determine what incentive is appropriate?
I would presume, Your Honor, that they're considering the factors that are set out under Criminal Rule 46. But I think this is something that the Rules Committee intended to leave to the discretion of trial court judges who are there on the ground in assessing these individuals.
Would you agree that the as-applied test presents some problems for your office in this case, as-applied?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor. Do you have a reason why?
Is there a reason why in the record before us?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Is there a reason why in the record before us? I thought the judge just said we're not doing that.
I don't believe there's any indication in the record of why the judge has made these determinations. The record is rather thin in terms of...
I guess I'm agreeing with Justice O'Donnell. We don't really care why. Can you find a rational basis for someone to say, blanket, no?
I believe the rational basis would be simply that the court believes that this is the appropriate level of an incentive to get the defendant to appear. One thing I want to point out is I don't know that there is anything in evidence that any of these people were not able to get out of jail. I think that's an important factor. Eight out of 10 of the Licking County example cases, they were able to get out of jail, and the other two pled guilty.
Counsel, the relators argue that this court has three times said you can't do these kinds of things, at least being the most recent case, right? In that case, a different part of the rule was in play, was it not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And in that case, the judge was insisting on all cash, was he not?
Correct, Your Honor.
Which is substantially different.
That is substantially different. This is not a case of the quote-unquote cash-only bonds that were at issue in Jones or in Smith. In both of those cases, the particular rules at issue, first of all, gave the defendants a panoply of options, whether it was current Relay 3 or prior Rule C4. The court was, I think, they're concerned with the court, this court was concerned with the trial court limiting the options that the rule provided, whereas here, obviously, the rule is quite different. This is not the case of that. And this is not a cash-only bond. This is a sort of a case in which we have some confusing terms, cash-only, et cetera.
Well, in lease, wouldn't it be the case that effectively the court said no bond by setting
that is correct, Your Honor.
That was the undercurrent in the lease case, was
yes,
it not?
It was very much an undercurrent in that case. It was $1 million cash-only bond, and it was clear that the purpose was to deprive the person of getting out of jail. That's not the case here. As I said, eight out of 10 of these Licking County example cases, the people were able to get out. And this is not a 100% cash bond. It's a 10% cash, and it's a 10% cash and 90% surety or bond.
Counsel, does your argument change then depending on the percentage that we're talking about? What if the rule were changed to say 50, 50-50?
If this was a 50% situation or an 80% situation, I think the answer would change. But I think this rule exists against a background in which the defendants are paying 10% to somebody, and this gives them an opportunity to receive 90%.
What about the higher the bond amount that 10% is figured on? It could be as prohibitive, depending on the financial circumstances of the defendant. So you say 10%, and I noticed, I think, in your brief, did you use the term 90% recognizant? And 10% cash?
I think the idea there, Your Honor, was that this
is... Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. The 10%, if we have a $100,000 bond and you have to pay 10% cash, that's a pretty high dollar amount, is it not?
It is, and I think that would factor into the court's evaluation of what was appropriate, but I would also submit that...
But you say even under those circumstances... where you, as a defendant, need to come up with $10,000, that's okay.
I think that doesn't deprive the defendant of access to a surety, because the defendant can use a surety to pay that money and can use a surety to be on the hook for the remaining 90%. If you're concerned that it's going to get into the realm of excessive bail, that's a different question. And I would submit that to the extent that that's a concern, that this is going to preclude people from getting out of jail, that then in individual cases, through the habeas process or through a request for bail modification, that the excessive bail framework would then be the appropriate way to address that in an individual case in which it was excessive or appeared to be excessive. Your Honors, I would just like to submit, I see my time is up, that we would request that the court deny the writ, and I would submit that rather than, especially given the court statements in Smith versus Lees that Criminal Rule 46A2 was written to comply with the Constitution, and that it didn't provide for prohibited cash-only bonds, and the 11th District's opinion in Williams v. Fankhauser, that a writ of mandamus isn't the way to resolve this. If the court has concerns about the rule, that perhaps the best way is to return to the Rules Committee rather than issue a writ of mandamus against these relators. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Thompson, do you have anything to add? Thank you. All right, counsel, you've used all your time. You may take 1 minute.
Andrew Miller, unduly detained, 3 months. Abigail Hale, 22 days. Brittany Hill, 54 days. Carl Flanagan, 15 days. One of these persons only had a $2,500 bail and stayed in jail 15 days. This court has already determined.
Were these all innocent people?
I'm sorry?
Were these all innocent people that you just articulated?
Your Honor, every person is innocent until proven guilty.
Well, ultimately, I'm...
At this point, Your Honor, respectfully, I don't know, and it doesn't matter because they had a right under the Ohio Constitution to be bailable by a sufficient surety. That's what this court has stated. This court has already ruled that a cash-only bond in any form is unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.